The fourth and final episode is a bonus track, not really a Fry's English Delight at all. In fact, it's complete rubbish linguistically. The Joy of Gibberish.
I would like to start off, if I may, by qualifying this nonsense, which of course is really a very serious thing in the form of the Basic English 20 Fido. It comprised the vowel sound and threp, so please don't confuse or stretch the pigeonholes of your mind to encompass what these sounds really are.
Professor Stanley Unwin, giant of gibberish, god of gobbledygook, the man who, more than any other, opened our generation's ears to the poetic, linguistic, humorous and educational benefits of singing, writing, appreciating and, of course, talking tosh.
Boom. Ooh. Yatta-ta-ta.
Boom.
Ooh. Yatta-ta-ta.
Boom.
Ooh. Yatta-ta-ta.
So, a strangely familiar land, yet one in which nothing is linguistically as it seems, where intelligibility has been sacrificed on the altar of entertainment. Or not. Question one. Listen to the following and discuss. True gibberish should be totally devoid of meaning.
I was quite flummoxed by an outrageous cat. It was a Chinese warlord by the name of... I can't remember.
And now this.
1x2 2, 2x2 4, 3x2 6, 4x2 8, 5x2 10, 6x2 12, 7x2 14, 8x2 16, 9x2 18, 10x2 20.
Yes, well done. Double Dutch, which is quite literally what that was. The two times table in Dutch. With apologies to Dutch listeners, and a note to self that we must tread carefully if we wish not to give gratuitous offence, and even more carefully if we do wish to give it. It is possible to argue that anything unintelligible is ipso facto gibberish, but remember that one man's gibberish may well be another woman's native tongue. But why, precisely, are we so enamoured of this particular kind of nonsense? That is what we are here to find out. Or are we? Perhaps it's just our little excuse simply to celebrate the phenomenon. After all, wouldn't it be a somewhat oxymoronic exercise, not to mention a disrespectful one, to try perversely to invest meaning in what sets out to be deliberately devoid of any meaning whatsoever? So exercise two, then. Distinguish between nonsense, per se, and sheer gibberish.
On the ning-nang-nong, where the cows go bong, and the monkeys all say boo, there's a nong-nang-ning, where the trees go ping, and the teapots jibber-jabber-joo. On the nong-ning-nang, all the mice go clang, and you just can't catch them when they do. So it's ning-nang-nong, cows go bong, nong-nang-ning, trees go bing, nong-ning-nang, the mice go clang. What a noisy place to belong is the ning-nang-ning-nang-nong.
Well, I would suggest that whereas nonsense may have a logic and a form and a function and mirror grammatical rules and, whisper it behind your hand, a hidden meaning, whether intended or not, gibberish, and many a dictionary definition will support me here, doesn't. It doesn't aspire to any of these. It does no more than imitate the sounds of our near neighbours for our delight and delectation. No, not the Dutch in this case. No, our biological neighbours, the other primates further down the evolutionary chain. And that's right, the Americans.
All night long they chatter away, all day long they were happy and gay, swinging and singing in the honky-tonky way.
To gibber might not be to imitate the action of the tiger. It's more akin to the apparently inchoate vocalizings of the ape and gibbon, the marmoset, the chimpanzee and the monkey. So exercise three, then. Listen to the following, then discuss the proposition that animals speak better gibberish than humans.
Do, do, do the funky gibber. We are here to show you how.
Tinky Winky.
Gipsy.
La la.
So, with thanks to the goodies, Teletubbies and others, I reckon we can postulate that gibberish is a universal language spoken by more humans than Mandarin Chinese and Spanish put together. I'm thinking of one kind of human here. Any ideas? Hands up, anybody?
Oh, hide up, petal bottle.
Hide up, petal bottle.
That's a clue. These are all fluent, natural gibberish speakers, yet few, if any, understand gibberish or even the concept of gibberish, and they don't speak any other languages. Exactamundo. Our first language, virtually our mother tongue, is gibberish out of the mouths of babes and sucklings, as well as all that dribbly stuff. And here we may have our first insight into the phenomenon. Gibberish is much prized by children. It's not, I would suggest, altogether an accident that nursery rhymes and playground chants contain more than an element of the stuff. It's part of the way newcomers to verbal communication explore the language. Dr. Julia Gillan is part of the Centre for Language and Communication at the Open University, and she has studied language development in children.
At around 6 weeks of age, in fact, babies often start doing something we call cooing, and it's a quite spontaneous behaviour, but quite universal, and it's sometimes referred to as mewling or gurgling.
Of course, many television programmes for children deliberately create their characters with the speech patterns appropriate to their intended viewers' ages, Teletubbies and Pingu amongst them.
Enjoy my request, eh? I'm not a bad dinner.
Even 2 months old babies have been shown to play with sound in a two-way interaction between two people. And there's a pattern there of imitating and making new initiations in the pattern. The Edinburgh psychologist Colin Trevathan calls them proto-conversations, and he suggests that interactions between two-month-old babies in dyadic, two-way interactions, could be the most important precursor of language learning. When a baby's 7 months old, then babbling usually appears. And what we call canonical babbling is when a consonant is interspersed in the vowel-like sound. So very typically, ba, ba-ba-ba-ba, ma, ma-ma-ma-ma, di-di-di-di-di, some sort of thing like that. And that parents, it's been shown in studies across the world, are very keen on picking up at this stage. They always identify exactly when it occurs, and they tend immediately to start matching that to words that they want to. So, for example, mama, mama is overinterpreted as indicating mum. Babbling shows a very early predisposition, as it were, to attention to rhythm and intonation and repetition in language, all of which are shown to be very important in later processes of word learning. I think that we could reasonably trace some continuity between the kinds of sounds that are appealing in children's earliest vocalisations, the babas, the mamas, with the later appeal of rhyme, of alliteration, of onomatopoeia, of all kinds of sound play, including play with frequency and pitch that happen later on. There's clearly a great appeal to children for nonsense. I remember when I was little, for example, in Essex in the 1960s, that the rhyme that began, I went to a Chinese restaurant, for me went to eeny, meeny, macaraca, rompompooly, ompompush. And I was interested to see that some researchers have identified very similar patterns in various countries, even Australia, for example, at the same time was doing a, I went to a Chinese restaurant, and there it became a ooey-oo-ah, ting-tang-walla-walla, bing-bang-bong. It's enjoying language while communicating with another person in a relationship which is found to be enjoyable by both. That's really an essence of language learning.
Fun for all guaranteed. We may well deduce, then, that gibberish is an element of creative play universal in language development, following definable patterns. But that doesn't solve the problem, for its function is almost incidental to the pleasure we take in it. A frabjous joy, indeed. For it is the sound that gives delight, the sound itself, dislocated from meaning, dismembered from sense, disjointed from any communicative function. Repetition is part of the recipe. Repetition is a large part of the recipe. Repetition is an essential part of the recipe. Then, as we have heard, modifications to the basic word, concatenations, exaggerations, obfuscations with their ramifications, and elusive, abusive atoms of alliteration are allowed, absolutely. Often in time, we add rhyme.
'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogroves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jubjub bird, and shun the frumious Bandersnatch.
Sometimes we become so fond of these nonsense poems that we appropriate their invented words into our general vocabularies. And in this way, gibberish sneaks into the side entrance of accepted language, disguised in the ill-fitting clothes of neology. The ersatz is translated into the echt, or Vorsprung durch Technik, some might say. Although not I, obviously. Creating neologisms can be immense fun, especially if they become part of a worldwide vocabulary. The whole experience can be simply... Aha, did that catch you out? The famous Mary Poppins song, only sung in Hebrew. So why translate a made-up word? One can only assume it's more amusing and more grammatical in Hebrew to normalise the adjectival form, even if, by so doing, one thereby nullifies its gibberish quotient. However, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious is perhaps not quite true gibberish, in that we can divine some meaning or function in the word, or at least invest it with one. The creation of meaninglessness, pure meaninglessness in language, is a far more vexed affair. It's not as easy as it might appear to write utter rubbish. We have to look to Dada.
Da, da, da. Da, da, da. Da, da, da.
No, not that kind of Dada. That kind either. The real Dadaists were the lads who made a proper, concerted effort to make gibberish a true literary form in the early years of the last century. In their attempts to reject the norms of the time, they tried all kinds of things, random collections of words, automatic speech, anything, to achieve a true iconoclastic total nonsense. Anything to divorce words from their meanings, associations, resonances. And one of the heirs to that tradition was the German painter Kurt Schwitters, whose sound poem Ursonate follows the pattern of a musical sonata. He dispensed with words altogether and wrote sounds. Here's part of it. A fragment of Ursonate. In toto, it lasts for more than half an hour, performed there by Jaap Blonk, whose name is a credit to his art. George Melly, whose talents are too numerous to mention, once found a highly practical use for that very poem in Manchester. Shall we lend him our ears?
We were playing in a pub, Mick Mulligan and his band and myself. Now, Mulligan had gone into the loo in the interval and removed one thug who was kicking another one, possibly another thug, on the floor of the lavatory. Mulligan was very strong, so he pulled him off and threw him out. And at the end, when they were packing up their instruments, I went outside. There was this same thug with his mates, about four of them, I would have said, and they all had empty bottles, and they were all banging them against the wall. And they advanced on me, banging their bottles, eventually intending to break them and no doubt redecorate my face, as they say in some places. I didn't know quite what to do. I thought, well, I can't fight them. I had actually in my pocket at that time a book called Schwitters in England, which contained a lot of his poems and so on. I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll shout some schwitters at them, because he wouldn't expect that. I think in boxing you have to catch your opponent on the wrong foot, as it were. So I began. I went, Fums brrti tuperg, fums brrti tuperg, fums brrti tupergif. Quee, 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 rakadarintakada, rakadarintakada, and so on. And they ran away. Maybe they thought it was some kind of voodoo spell, and that this noise would turn them all into toads, maybe, or something like that. So anyway, they ran. That was the relief.
Ah, magic. And why not? For if music hath power to soothe the savage breast, so too hath the human voice. Listen to psychotherapist Ingrid Collins.
Human sounds do have a kind of magic invested in them. Sound is a form of energy, and energy affects our body in a subtle way, as well as the recognised meaning of a word. Certain religious practices repeat mantras because they actually do have an effect on the mind. Partly it's a hypnotic effect. It's thought that these sounds take the consciousness into an altered state. The meaning of enchantment is actually from the root of to chant, to sing together, and the unity that it brings to the group is like emotional and spiritual glue. Repetition is always hypnotic because the point is reached where the meaning of whatever word is lost and the pattern of the sound takes over.
That repetition is one of the keys. It used to be said that if you uttered the name Dagwood Bumstead over and over, then it would either lead you into a state of higher consciousness or drive you mad. Try it. Dagwood Bumstead. Only don't try it now.
The chanting in a football match can be intimidating. War chants of warriors can be very intimidating, and obviously this is why they exist.
Ah yes, the war chant, putting your tongue out at potential aggressors. Literally, in the case of that Maori haka, metaphorically, in the case of Hawaiians, and satirically, in the case of Spike Jones. But were Spike and his city slickers really being slick with the Hawaiian, or were they just rendering it into gibberish? And does it matter? Exercise 3, bluff your way in gibberish, with actor Victor Spinetti.
Well, it's a tune of language that always interested me. For example, when we were doing Oh, Lovely War, the Joan Littlewood production, She said to us during rehearsals, what do they say, those drill sergeants? And anyone been in the army? And I said, well, yes, I was in the army. And she said, what do they say? I said, I don't know. I said, but it sounded like, you can't have a sudden medal against the roof, you get the charge now. You have a house all in, and you get the charge in, and you get the money move. You have a charge in the jeep, and you get the charge hard, and you're all right in the law. And since that was the tune of this, she said, well, that'll do. And that became the sketch. I mean, I did it for about two or three minutes. Of the fun of the sketch was, of course, it was the look on the other actors' faces because they never knew what I was saying. And that made the sketch. But that was the rhythm. That was the tune of the man. It's all rhythm. Welsh, for example, I can't speak a word of Welsh. But when I won the Tony Award in New York, I didn't expect to win because I was up against quite big guns. And when Carol Channing said, and the winner is Victor Spinelli, I thought, oh, I've got to say something. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm walking up to the podium. This is live, coast-to-coast television in America. And I thought, no, all you have to do is thank people. So I said, I'd like to make my acceptance speech in the language of the country of my birth. And they thought Italian, right? And then I went, Hernaura dir, chaniad, bladwna sy'n gychir, de gethion sy'n jwn, it'll work. The audience. And the other hour, a blether na city here, a chanyon of the producer, David Merrick. And our here, a gathwana see he garwar the cast. And I came off and people were crying. Oh, from that little country, Victor, how wonderful.
Victor Spinetti with his personal form of gibberish. And if we're talking cunning linguists, then we really must not ignore the Irish. And I mean that in the most complimentary sense. David Norris is a senator in the Irish Parliament. Qualification alone, you might think, to pontificate here upon our chosen subject. But more pertinently, he is also an expert on the Irish language and in James Joyce in particular. Why does gibberish sound so at home in Ireland?
Irish people like the sound, they like the fun, they like the shape. And we're really rather like Humpty Dumpty in Alice in Wonderland. You know, who said words mean what I want them to mean, no less and no more, and that is our attitude towards language. I think part of the reason that Irish people have this facility and particular attitude towards language is because in the middle of the 19th century, as a result of the famine, a lot of people emigrated. We lost nearly 2 million people. And in order to emigrate, they had to abandon the Irish language, which was saturated in the rhythmic returns of nature and natural imagery and so on from farming and fishing and the countryside generally, and go for the imperial language of English, which was the language of travel, the language of practicality and reason. They'd lost the language of romance and improvisation and so on. All they were left with was the English, which wasn't as satisfactory from their point of view. And Joyce refers to this where he says in A Portrait of the Artist, my soul frets in the shadow of his language. How different are the words home, Christ, ale, master on his lips and on mine. And this fretting in the shadow of a language, this grating of two language systems, one half forgotten and one grudgingly accepted, helped to create the unease, which, if you like, led to the pearl of the Irish literary revival. In Finnegan's Wake, he invented a complete new language, which was a dream language. He was telling the history of world civilization in the form of a dream of a Dublin publican who, a little bit tipsy at the end of the night, goes to sleep and descends down through levels of consciousness, and we descend down with him until we're in the dream state, and things are not entirely logical. They're fluid, they're plastic, and so is language. And Joyce used over 60 world languages to give him hints for puns and suggestions and phrases and so on. And it does sometimes look like complete nonsense. Some people thought it was a big practical joke and that it was all a surrealistic piece of nonsense. But Joyce, even here, was the great classical artist. He knew the meaning of every syllable. And he actually says in this new language, he says, no, it is not a hyacinthinous riot of blurs and blots and bars and balls and hoops and wriggles. It only looks as like it as damn it. And you find that if you scan the language there, even the most extraordinary things seem to have a meaning. I mean, there is one word at the opening of Finnegan's Wake, 100 letters long, 2.5 lines. But if you scan it, you find that it follows the pattern of English prosody. It's iambic, ba-dump, 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 and you realise that it is, in fact, the first of a series of peals of thunder. And you can actually hear it, the fall. And And of course it is thunder, but most people would think it was gibberish because they're not used to trying to read one word that is so long.
We have heard snippets of all kinds of music throughout our journey, for the place of gibberish in music is not insignificant. Indeed, there are no fewer than two whole musical genres devoted to gibberish. In the beginning, we have the non-word, scat. And later, we have bebop's answer to scat, doo-wop, which raises some very serious questions all on its own, such as...
Who put the bop in the bop-a-bop-a-bop? Who put the ram in the ram-a-lam-a ding dong?
And these discrete genres ignore the plethora of songs over the centuries that substitute gibberish for meaningful lyrics. Consider the fields of folded diddle-i-rolls, the acres of la-la-la-la-las, the mountains of hey-nonny-nonnies. Would you mind awfully stopping that now? Thank you. And we haven't even mentioned the Eurovision Song Contest with its vacuous pan-European boom-banger-banger-binger-babbly-babble-bopper-lula. Which is pretty much where we came in. So, to conclude, gibberish is literate and illiterate, dialectical and paradoxical. It denies the formalities of language while seeming to imitate it. It is spoken by many, recognised by all, and understood by none. It hints at beauty and truth. It plays with language and with us. It speaks to our very being. Which puts me in mind of an apposite graffito, which is said to have appeared on a wall in one of our senior seats of learning. Solemnly inscribed was the phrase, "To do is to be," Jean-Jacques Rousseau, under which someone else had written, "To be is to do," Jean-Paul Sartre. Underneath that, in yet a third hand, appeared the immortal words, "Doobie-doobie-doo," Frank Sinatra. We cannot leave this celebration of the joy of gibberish without a final word from the grand panjandrum of gibbery-pokery, Stanley Unwin. I hope it's been fun, even if you haven't understood a word of it. Especially if you haven't understood a word of it. That, my dears, is the whole point.
There is a deep joy, and while everybody here is laughing their broken heads off and lebbers like a sawn-off shot gold, I hand you back to the roofless where our studio has beamed on the great load.
That was The Joy of Gibberish, presented by me, Stephen Fry. The programme was a testbed production for Radio 4, and the producer was Dagwood Bumstead.
And that's it for this series of Fry's English Delight. It was produced by Nick Baker and Ian Gardhouse for Testbed Productions and published by BBC Audiobooks.